From Ohio to Iowa, Minnesota to Arizona, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, increasing investment in distressed communities is the goal of Opportunity Zones. Here to discuss what they are and how they work is Jimmy Kemp from the Jack Kemp Foundation. Democrats have control of the U.S. House of Representatives, but Nancy Pelosi may not have the votes needed to become Speaker. Andy Roth of the Club for Growth has the real story. The competition is over, and Amazon has chosen to split its new HQ2 between Northern Virginia and New York City. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine breaks down the deal with Michael Farron of the Mercatus Center. And the midterm elections divided the nation. Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA looks to a 19th century icon as an example of the qualities needed to restore unity. He has an American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. A major hurdle to improving distressed communities is getting the capital investment needed to build new housing and establish new businesses. Opportunity zones are one way to get that capital. Jimmy Kemp is president of the Jack Kemp Foundation. He's here to discuss opportunity zones and why they are important. Jimmy, welcome to American Radio Journal. Jimmy, when we talk about opportunity zones, before we get into how this came about and what you did this past week to honor those who brought it about, tell us, what is an opportunity zone? What is the concept all about?
Opportunity zones are an incentive to get unrealized capital gains that investors have invested in distressed communities. And really, the core of the concept is because our tax code is so stinking complicated and it's way too big, and we don't have the simple tax code that we would all love to have and we believe we should have. Well, in lieu of that, while it's as complicated as it is, we need to figure out ways to incentivize folks to do things that don't require the government to pat them on the head or say, you did bad, you did good. And so opportunity zones are a free market idea to unleash unrealized capital gains into distressed communities by providing, on the front end, a 7-year deferral of any capital gains from any investment, and on the back end, any investment that realizes a profit after 10 years. You have to hold the investment in a distressed community for 10 years, but if you hold it for 10 years and that investment has to do well, and then you sell that equity investment, and there is 0% capital gains on that distressed community investment that would have succeeded. I know that's not perfectly clear, but ask me more questions and maybe we can make it a little bit better.
Well, first of all, when you talk about these investments, Jimmy, are you talking about housing for individuals? Are you talking about businesses? What are we talking about here?
An opportunity fund. Anybody can create an opportunity fund, an LLC, an individual, and you can invest in a distressed community through real estate, through a business. Treasury actually just released the regulations on opportunity zones, which was just passed into law in December of 2017. And so lots of those questions are actually being ironed out right now, but the intent is to allow any business, any investor to say, hey, there's a project, there's a business in this distressed community, and each of those communities were chosen by the governor of that state. And so if someone were to Google opportunity zones and Pennsylvania, they would see all the opportunity zones in Pennsylvania. And then you'd have the opportunity to invest in, whether it's real estate or a business, those would be qualified investment opportunities because they're in an opportunity zone. And the IRS would allow you to defer paying any capital gains on whatever money you put into the opportunity fund, and then if you held it for 10 years and it was a success, then you pay 0% capital gains.
So why would these opportunity funds be needed? People, I assume, wouldn't be able to go through regular bank financing or other financing agencies to get this in money to invest?
So the root of it is back in the 1980s, my father had legislation called enterprise zones. And my dad deeply believed that America, the American idea, relies on equality of opportunity. In our democratic republic, in our capitalist system, if there are communities that don't have access to capital investment, we should try to encourage that. And instead of developing dependence upon government in poor areas, the goal of enterprise zones was to unleash capital in poor communities. And you're right, poor communities were historically targeted as bad lending zones. Effectively, banks would redline areas, and my dad's concept, my dad, by the way, as some listeners may not be aware, was Jack Kemp, who was a vice presidential nominee in 1996, congressman for 18 years in the 70s and 80s, but most importantly, he was a NFL football player. I think that's what he was most proud about.
Yes.
for 13 years with the Buffalo Bills. But he wanted to green line those redlined areas and zero out the capital gains tax and unleash free enterprise in those areas, because he believed that capitalism without capital is nothing but an ism. And so he wanted to utilize the tax code to not try to make the government do more, not have some bureaucrat make a decision about what a good investment is or not. Let the free market work. Let people say, hey, I want to pay 0% cap gains. Let me look at these areas, whether they be enterprise zones or now opportunity zones. And the reality, the award we just gave to Sean Parker the other night was because Sean Parker, the co-founder of Napster, he revamped enterprise zones. And it was his vision to create these opportunity zones. And it's a bill that passed in the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017, co-sponsored by Republican Tim Scott and Democrat Cory Booker, two people who you wouldn't think would see much eye to eye, being from different sides of the aisle, but both of them care deeply about getting urban communities restored, and we think, and they think, a critical component of that is getting capital to look at the opportunities that exist in distressed communities.
We have been talking with Jimmy Kemp, who is president of the Jack Kemp Foundation. We've been talking about opportunity zones. They honored Sean Parker at their banquet this past week. So, Jim, tell us a little bit about the Jack Kemp Foundation. Where can folks go on the internet to learn more?
So jackkempfoundation.org is our website, two Ks back-to-back there. I founded the Kemp Foundation in 2009, shortly after my dad passed away. He'd been sick with melanoma cancer for 6 months, and I realized during the outpouring of love and affection for him when people learned he was sick, how important he was to American politics in the 20th century. And he's really well known for Kemp Roth, for the 86 tax reform. He was a part of President Ronald Reagan's team at that time. And his mission and vision was to advance the American idea. And the core of the American idea, as you know, is the human idea, given a time and a place to happen. And that's what America is, understanding that we have God-given natural rights to pursue life, liberty, and happiness. And this is a great country, but it requires all of us to understand the principles on which we stand and to participate, to engage. And we set up the foundation, and we have a bunch of Kemp Forum events throughout the year. The jackkempfoundation.org website gives more background, but it's a real privilege for me to be able to tell people about my pops and remind people about the importance of the values on which we stand.
Jimmy Kemp of the Jack Kemp Foundation. Jimmy, thank you for taking time to be with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. We have some interesting storylines developing. We still have undecided elections, and we also have leadership battles in the U.S. Congress. Andy, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
Let's start out. This is becoming very fascinating. The Democrats have taken control of the U.S. House of Representatives. First of all, give us an overview as to where we stand. How big is the Democrat majority?
Well, right now, depending on, I guess, who you talk to, the Democrats have either 229 or 230 seats. You need 218 to pass legislation or to have a full majority if everybody is present and voting. And the Republicans have 200 seats. So you basically have a 29 or 30 seat margin. However, the key number here is 218. If the Democrats have 230, and sorry for all these numbers, they can't afford to lose more than 13 of their members on any single piece of legislation. So if they want to vote for tax increases or cap and trade or some sort of handout to labor unions, if they lose just 13 of their members, especially these Democrats that are freshmen and elected to red districts, then they can't pass anything. So that's the key, I think, going forward. Now, there are about 7 to 9 still to be called seats, and I think those are split half and half, meaning I suspect Republicans will win half of those and Democrats will win the other half. So maybe the Democrats will gain a few more seats overall.
So that's where we stand in terms of the numbers. And the election for Speaker of the House, obviously the most visible post in the House of Representatives, Nancy Pelosi, the Democrat leader, wants to be elected back to that post that she held previously. However, there is an element, Andy, in the Democrat conference that pledged during the campaign not to vote for her, given that 13-person lead that they have to lose. Are there more than 13 who are going to be in that boat?
Yeah, the key here is that the speaker's vote is on the floor, and it's very public, and it's both parties. So Republicans obviously will not vote for Pelosi for speaker. So for her to get the gavel, she needs to get 218 of her 230 Democrat members. And that is going to prove very difficult. In fact, I think so much so that I'd be willing to predict that she does not become speaker. Let's just say that when the dust settles, the Democrats have a 13 or 14 seat margin. That means that she cannot afford to lose 13 or 14 of her members. There are 10 Democrat freshmen, as of now, who pledged publicly not to support her. And then you have some incumbent Democrats who are ready to replace her. So just right there, you think that there are enough numbers to defeat her. That's when things get interesting. Now, if, let's say she gets 217 votes, she's one vote short. What happens is that nobody is speaker, and that both parties retire to their cloakrooms, and then they just need to haggle privately on how to get to 218. That may mean twisting arms for Pelosi to get 218, or it may mean that she needs to step aside and somebody else come up. The Democrats will do whatever it takes to get to 218. So it's not like Republicans have a chance here to become speaker themselves. One interesting thing that could occur that would allow Pelosi to be speaker is that these 10 freshmen who said that they wouldn't vote for her, they could try to wiggle out of that and say, well, I upheld that campaign promise. I voted against her on the first ballot. But when she couldn't win after the first ballot and it was clear that nobody else could win, then I freed myself and voted for her on the second ballot. So it's a slimy way of getting out of a campaign pledge, but they could probably say with a somewhat straight face that they didn't support her and that they upheld the campaign pledge. So that's probably the only way she can become speaker. Otherwise, I think you'll see somebody else in the party, somebody younger and a fresher face, become speaker.
Any names being bandied about for that? The member who was planning to challenge her for speaker lost his primary.
Joe Crawley from New York, he lost his primary, so I would have suspected he would have got it. But to be honest with you, I do not have my pulse on the Democrat Party and how they operate. Tim Ryan from Ohio has always had ambitions. He's always thought about challenging Pelosi, but he never has. Seth Moulton from Massachusetts I think, has been pretty vocal. I don't know if he has the votes. And then there are others. So it'll just be fun to watch this shake out. The Democrats have to vote on their leaders privately November 28th. And the way that works is there's the Democrat conference informally announces who they support for speaker, and Pelosi will win that on November 28th because that's a private ballot and it's a secret ballot, and you just need the majority of the Democrat conference. So of the 230 Democrats, she just needs to get a majority of those. And what they do is they privately say, okay, my colleagues, we've now supported Pelosi privately. We need to formally reaffirm that on the floor. But those House freshman Democrats will say, well, I pledge not to. So the real vote is on the floor, but there is going to be an informal one on November 28th that will be just as important to watch.
We will keep a very close eye on that over the next week or two here, or however long it might take. Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. Andy, tell us a bit about the club.
Sure thing. The Club for Growth is a membership organization out of Washington, D.C., but we have over 250,000 members from all across the country, from all walks of life, and we're united because we believe in economic freedom. If your listeners are interested, they can go to our website at www.clubforgrowth.org, and if they like what they see, they can join for free.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. Andy, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
Amazon has chosen Northern Virginia and New York City to host its new headquarters. Taxpayers are going to pay a large price for the honor. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine gets details from Michael Farron of the Mercatus Center.
After months of consideration and bids from more than 100 cities across the country, Amazon has decided to locate its second headquarters in two places, actually. The economic and political capitals of the United States. Yes, the online retailing giant is coming to Queens, New York, and Arlington, Virginia, just across the rivers, respectively, from Manhattan and Washington, D.C. And Amazon will cash in on more than $2.5 billion in taxpayer subsidies from the states of New York and Virginia for locating their new headquarters in those places. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Michael Farron. He is a research fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, and he's been following all the drama around these Amazon bids, and he joins us now to talk about the economics of these big corporate subsidies. Michael, thanks for taking some time and being here.
No problem. Glad to be here, Eric.
So Amazon says it's going to bring 25,000 jobs to each of the new headquarters in New York and Northern Virginia, 50,000 jobs in total. They're getting a lot of money for that. It works out to somewhere about $50,000 to $60,000 per job. Michael, give us your thoughts on these two selections, these cities that were picked ahead of, say, Atlanta or Dallas, places that may have been considered bigger favorites when the bidding process began.
Well, the decision makes exact sense because Amazon is pursuing the tech talent that will enable it to continue growing as quickly into the future as it's already been growing, having gone from a small internet book sales company to one of the largest world's largest corporations in just 20 years. But the important part of that is that subsidies were never a big part of the decision for Amazon to locate where it chose. At the end of the day, it's business factors that affect its growth potential and future profitability that matter much more than government handouts.
Yeah, you know, I think it's interesting that that Amazon didn't go for some of the bigger incentive packages that were out there. I mean, there was certainly more cash on the table than what they took. Maryland offered something like $8 billion. New Jersey offered $5 billion. So, I mean, look, I don't want to downplay it. These are still really big numbers, $2.5 billion combined from New York and Virginia, but not as astronomical as it could have been. New York is offering about $1.5 billion and then just about a half a billion dollars from Virginia as well. Why do you think Amazon went with New York and D.C. instead of taking some of the bigger piles of cash, some of the more lucrative options that were out there?
But at the end of the day, it suggests that even New York City and Virginia and Nashville, which is offering another $100 million for the smaller distribution center or the logistics center that will be located there, they really didn't need to offer that anyway, even those smaller subsidies, because Amazon is chasing things that will allow it to grow in the future. Nashville has logistics aspects that make it unique, and that is why Amazon is locating there, not because of the $100 million subsidy. It represents a waste of taxpayer dollars, and it actually reduces future economic growth to spend resources in that way rather than promoting economic growth.
Right, right. So if Amazon is sending the signal that they're basing their decision on other factors, it's not just about the money, then that really kind of raises the question of why would you throw all that money at them in the first place? We are talking with Michael Farron. He's a research fellow at the Mercatus Center, and he's been following all these Amazon bids over the past year or so. Michael, one of the really striking things about this whole process to me has been the degree of secrecy surrounding the entire bidding process. We know a few of the bids, like those ones from Maryland and New Jersey that we already talked about, but we literally didn't know until today when the decision was announced. We didn't know what New York or Virginia had offered to Amazon, and we still don't know what many other cities and states offered as well. That secrecy really changes the dynamic in the way this process plays out. I mean, at least from the public's perspective, right? Shouldn't taxpayers get to know what their elected officials are offering on their behalf before a decision like this gets made?
Absolutely. And actually, a lot of city council members have spoke up arguing the same thing in New York City and Austin, Texas, and many other places. They say that we don't even know what the bids are being offered in our name, and then we're going to be handed a subsidy package and expected to vote on it in a very short time period. As far as I know, nothing has actually gone through the Virginia legislature or the New York legislature. Perhaps they're using existing subsidy programs that are already in place to allow this, and so that didn't require active involvement by the local and state governments. But yes, the fact that it's done in secret allows massive corporations to go ahead and play cities off against each other, and it ends up bidding up the size of the subsidy that would have been offered over what would have been offered in an open competition.
Yeah, and of course, if you throw all that money at one business, it means you're just shifting that tax burden onto everyone else. I mean, big tax breaks for Amazon means somebody else has to make up that difference. And one big employer gets the break at the expense of everyone else. We only have about a minute left, Michael, but I know you've done some research into this at Mercatus. So tell us about that.
Our recent paper suggests that for the average size of the subsidy offered to Amazon, which was $6.75 billion at the state level, that the average state could cut its corporate income tax by 29%.
I guess it's fair to say that that's really the unseen part of this. New York, not a great tax climate for business by any means. They may have been better off with lower taxes across the board, lowering that corporate tax rate 20% or something instead of landing all these jobs at Amazon. But, you know, that's the trade-off, I guess, policymakers have to make. And unfortunately, we don't have any more time today to get further into that. Thank you so much to Michael Farron for joining us here on the program.
Thanks, Eric.
And again, that is Michael Farron. He is a research fellow at the Mercatus Center. Check out his work, including that paper on Amazon's tax breaks and what states could have done with that money instead, at Mercatus.org. And you can check out our coverage of the Amazon HQ2 decisions at Reason.com. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Catch us right back here again next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
The recent midterm elections revealed a nation divided, but we have had worse divisions in the past. Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA has an American Radio Journal commentary on the way forward.
In one way or another, I've participated in the American political process for more than 50 years. I've been a voter, a volunteer, a candidate, a donor, a consultant, a writer, a broadcaster, an elected official, and a committee man in my local Republican Party. I've been part of thrilling victories and agonizing defeats. But never have I seen our nation, community, and even families as bitterly contentious and divided as now. I'm confident that it was even worse in the 19th century, but not in my lifetime. The just concluded midterm elections provide a good opportunity to look at ourselves, not unlike halftime in a football game. The New York Times a week ago concluded this: "The midterm elections on Tuesday laid bare the growing chasm between urban and rural America, leaving Republicans deeply concerned about their declining fortunes in the metropolitan areas that extinguished their House majority, and Democrats just as alarmed about their own struggles to win over voters in states that strengthened the GOP's grip on the Senate. For both parties, the election represented an acceleration of dizzying realignment along cultural lines. districts that once represented the beating heart of the Republican Party rejected President Trump's avowed nationalism as a form of bigotry, while Democrats further retrenched from the agricultural and industrial communities where they once dominated. Close quote. I suppose it's ironically appropriate that the Gettysburg Times would echo Lincoln's words when it asked, "Has America become a house divided?" One of its journalists wrote, quote, "I was at a gathering in Gettysburg that was attended by both red, conservative, voters and blue, liberal voters. I was surprised and dismayed to hear blues report that they had been called anti-democratic and unpatriotic, and reds explained that they had been called Nazis and racists. There are people on both extremes who profit from our division. We have been manipulated and tricked, but we have a choice. We can decide, as the people of this great nation, to go another way. We can choose to work together so we all win." Close quote. The proliferation of cable news channels that compete with one another to see who can present news and opinion in the most startling and one-sided way results in people choosing sides before they understand issues. Depending on which side of the political and cultural divide we favor, we can find news sources that reinforce and confirm our biases rather than challenging them in the light of honest reporting of facts. What all of this shows and what the midterm elections confirmed is the increasing polarization of American politics in the 21st century, amplified by increasingly strident rhetoric. As bad as it may be, however, it really does pale in comparison to the polarization of the 19th century. Most obviously, that polarization reached its peak in the Civil War, but it also persisted for much of the rest of that century when the failure of the Reconstruction era was followed by the morally reprehensible Jim Crow era. Is there a lesson for us today to be learned from looking at how we survived that time of division? I believe that there is. One national leader stood taller than all the rest when he refused to abandon our great national ideals of equality, fairness, and freedom. One national leader eloquently uplifted our broadest shared values as the only unifying alternative to unending escalation of civic discord and partisan demonization. That national leader was Frederick Douglass. What America needs now is a 21st century Frederick Douglass, not more Republicans or Democrats or conservatives or progressives in positions of political power. The rhetorical divisiveness of both sides, and it is indeed a problem on both sides, is but a symptom of our deeper problem, a lack of unifying leadership. In this year in which we celebrate the bicentennial of Douglass's birth, we should re-examine his example and learn how it applies to our present crisis. David Blight's new book, Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom, is a good place to start. It's long at nearly 900 pages, but it's worth reading if your sense of patriotism is offended by the tone of many of the midterm campaigns and candidates. We need a leader like Douglass who will lift us out of the mud and once again inspire us to be the greatest, fairest, and most generous nation on earth. We need a new prophet of freedom, and he or she is unlikely to come out of the legion of mud wrestlers who sought our votes a week and a half ago. This has been Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring for American Radio Journal. Visit us on the web at letfreedomringusa.com.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including our newest affiliate, WFCA-FM in French Camp, Mississippi. Welcome to our new listeners in the Magnolia State. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.